familiar, the standard line on Noether's theorem is that it gives you this correspondence between continuous symmetries and some special conserved quantity, some quantity we really care about. These quantities get a special status in foundations of physics, and any work in philosophy and interpreting these theories that have these symmetries. We care a lot about these quantities. They're special. In the case of gauge symmetry, for the U1 symmetry of electromagnetism, the corresponding conserved quantity is, of course, electric charge. If you go further on to the non-abelian case, you have an SU3 gauge symmetry of quantum chromodynamics that leads to a conserved quantity of color charge. Now, in the case of electric charge, the real character of this quantity is familiar. We've studied it, and we've got a feel for what this quantity is. We're used to thinking of it in terms of little bits of +1 and little bits of -1. We're used to thinking of electrons and protons as having little bits of this charge, the sort of thing you can add up in various ways. We're used to thinking of how opposites attract, and like charges repel. We've got a feel for this property. What Noether's theorem gives you in this case, of course, is a divergence-free charge-current density. And if you integrate it in appropriate ways and all these things, you get a notion of the total charge Q in some region. And from the fact that the current is divergence-free, you can derive that this charge quantity Q will not change over time. Now, we're also accustomed to thinking of color charge as somehow analogous to electric charge. It's sort of the charge property in the case of the strong force. It does the thing in the case of the strong force that electric charge does for electromagnetism. We're also used to thinking of color charge as the sort of thing that lives in the that the quarks inside something like a proton have, and each of these quarks need to have one of the three different colors, red, blue, and green. But we have not the same sort of robust feel for what this property is that we do for electric charge. In particular, it's less common to talk about a current for color charge, at least in philosophy. And you might have thought from the beginning that what Noether's theorem would give you in this case would be a separate conservation of red and a conservation of blue and a conservation of green, because after all, those are the color charges, right? But it turns out that that's not the case. That's not what Noether's theorem gives you, at least from the beginning. So it turns out that when you get these conserved currents, in the color case, you add on this extra little index. I'm going to use the letter A for this. And mathematically, that's going to tell us that this transforms according to the adjoint representation of the group. And it's just a mathematical fact that those adjointy valued things don't correspond to the little piece of mathematics in the group theory that we use for red, blue, and green. And we'll see this in detail later. But so the question is, how does this Lie algebra valued thing relate to the red, blue, and green that I'm used to thinking of? What sort of quantity is it that Noether's theorem, in fact, gives you in this case? So broadly, I have just two main claims to make. And the first is just that Noether's theorem doesn't give you conservation of red, blue, and green separately. That's not the quantity that's conserved. And the second claim is that instead it does show that you have a conservation of this relational quantity of combinations of both color and anti-color. And we're going to use the group theory of SU3 to make this precise. So here's the plan. We're going to use scalar electrodynamics to get things going, just as a little refresher. It should be fairly familiar. And to keep things simple and tractable, we'll assume we're just dealing with scalar fields. As a homework assignment, you can reword all of this for direct fields. So then we'll look at the sort of unrealistic theory of scalar chromodynamics to better understand where the adjoint representation and the current comes in there. And then we'll look at a little bit of group representation theory to figure out what's going on with the adjoint representation and how it relates to these reds, blues, and greens. And then we'll return to sort of this philosophical question about what is this quantity of charge? How should we think of it? Okay, so scalar electrodynamics. Here's our Lagrangian for a charge scalar field. It should be fairly familiar. Phi here is our matter field. And d mu is our covariant derivative, where that a mu is our gauge field. And if you plug this into Noether's theorem with the U1 symmetry, out comes this conserved current. So this current is built out of those matter fields and the covariant derivative. And if you follow the sort of standard account, you'll find this in textbooks, you can integrate this thing to get this quantity of charge, total quantity of charge. Good. So that's one, that's the big main Noether's theorem notion of conservation of charge, which is showing you that this Q guy doesn't change over time. There's another related way of thinking of conservation of charge that I'll just gesture to here, and we might return to a bit at the end. So if you expand out this first kinetic term of the Lagrangian, it's a standard thing in textbooks to associate certain terms of that with as interaction terms between the matter field and the gauge field. And so kind of jumping ahead to ultimately down the line when we use this to do particle physics, we would associate with those first two terms Feynman diagrams of this sort, where the dashed line is our scalar field and the curvy line is the gauge field. So this could be ultimately something like an electron emitting a photon in the first case. And one way of thinking of conservation of charge here is that the total amount of charge at the vertex has to be conserved. Think of it at the vertex. So this is another way of thinking of conservation of charge. Okay, so that was just kind of aside. So now, how does this work when we want to go non-abelian and look at chromodynamics? So you have basically the same Lagrangian, but with two really fun new details. Phi is still our matter field, but now it has to have this extra index, and that's the place where the reds, blues, and greens come in. It's a three-dimensional thing. And that's going to correspond to a set of basis vectors for the first fundamental representation of SU3. And now our covariant derivative is the place where we pick up this extra index for the adjoint representation instead. So this little a, again, is for the Lie algebra of the group. And things with this a index transform according to the adjoint representation of SU3. And now this carries over when you look at the current associated with this Lagrangian, the current that Noether's theorem tells you is conserved. So if you expand all this out, you'll see that, it's the covariant derivative that brings in the adjointiness to the current. And so the question is to better understand how the property associated with this charge current density relates to those reds, blues, and greens of the little phi I guys. Okay. But at this stage, it should be clear that in the first instance, these group representations are hardwired into the expressions for the current. You have to care about group representations when you go non-abelian in a way that you actually don't have to when you're in the abelian case. And moreover, the key is that the current that transforms according to the adjoint representation that leads to this puzzle of how to understand the conserved quantity as relating to things that aren't in the adjoint representation. So now, we're ready to talk about those group representations. So, as I'm sure we all know, abstractly, right, a group is just a set with some multiplication operator on it that obeys certain axioms. And All Lie groups have these associated Lie algebras that serve as generators for the group. But when you want to think about how Lie groups especially work concretely, it's helpful to use a representation where you've mapped these abstract elements of the group and associated with them individually some matrix such that the matrix multiplication preserves the structure of the abstract group operation. So the way we do this is you pick your favorite vector space and you associate elements of the group with the general linear group on that vector space. We call that other underlying vector space the carrier space for the representation. And we say that the dimension of the representation is the same as the dimension of the vector space. For the special case of SUN, the type of groups that we're interested in this area of gauge theory, there are n minus one many fundamental representations. So called because you can build up higher level or higher dimensional representations out of these fundamental representations in special ways. So for the case of SU3 that we care about with color charge, you've got two fundamental representations. And those turn out to correspond to color on the one hand and anti-color on the other hand. So to make things nice and explicit, here's my favorite basis for C3. And I'm going to associate those properties of red, blue, and green with each with one basis vector for this vector space. So this is going to be a carrier space for the representation, the first fundamental representation of SU3. Now, to understand how the group actually acts on this space, we use a representation of the Lie algebra. So these are the famous Gell-Mann matrices. This is one basis for the Lie algebra in the first fundamental representation. Remember, the Lie algebra is itself a more abstract thing. It can be fully characterized by just the commutation relations of abstract elements, but it's nice to see it concretely as this set of 3x3 matrices. And you'll notice that two of them are kind of special. They're in bold because they're diagonal. And this is a general feature of Lie algebras, that there's some subalgebra that can be simultaneously diagonalized, and we call that the Cartan subalgebra. And this is important because we're going to use eigenvalues of these guys to distinguish the different representations, and those eigenvalues are called weights. Okay, so it's a lot of jargon, a lot of terminology, but where we're going is understanding how to systematically distinguish between various representations of the group, such as the fundamental representations and the adjoint representation. And it's that relationship we want to understand. So these weights are going to be useful for that. So for example, here's the Cartan subalgebra for SU3 acting on the blue state. And you take those simultaneous eigenvalues, you put that pair together, and you call that the weight of the vector B. You can obviously straightforwardly do the exact same thing for the two other colors, red and green. And if you do that, a really helpful way of organizing the information of these weights is to plot them in a weight space like this. Okay? So over there on the upper left, we have that blue state represented by the eigenvalue we just calculated. And if you calculated the same eigenvalues for red and green, you'd plot them in this way, straightforwardly. And the key is that for all the other representations you want to look at, you can plot their set of weights in the same space and use this whole space to coordinate your understanding of the different representations. So this is one way of building up the second fundamental representation of SU3. And this would be the basis that we'll use for the anti-colors. So the first one there, that bright blue, is anti-red. The middle kind of yellowy guy there is anti-blue. I believe, and the last one there, the magenta, is anti-green. Okay, so we're kind of exploiting this analogy with the ordinary sense of color to think of these as complementary, opposite colors. Okay. And we have a way of understanding the action of the group on this set of basis vectors to get the full representation. And if you go through the straightforward process of calculating eigenvalues and plotting them here, you'd get this triangle instead. So you put those together, you get a picture like this, which gives you a way of thinking about all these different, both color and anti-color states. Now, how is it that we distinguish between the representations? Well, you pick your favorite partial order on these weights, and you say different representations have different highest weights. You pick them out by their highest weight. Good. But again, the key is that we use this weight space to distinguish between inequivalent representations. So now the question is how to understand the adjoint representation using this tool of the weight space. Since that's the representation that corresponds to the conserved current whose status we want to understand. So again, a representation is this sort of map into the general linear group of some vector space, but it can really be any vector space you'd like. The Lie algebra itself is a vector space. It satisfies all the axioms you need for a vector space, and so you can use it as a carrier space for a very special representation. And when you do that, you get the adjoint representation. And so it's important now to kind of recognize that the Lie algebra is doing double duty. It's still the generators for the group. You can still exponentiate it to get all the elements of the group, but it's also now the carrier space for the representation. So when it generates some group elements that then act on that space, it looks like it's acting on itself, but it's playing two different roles there. And the actual action of the representation is conjugation, like so. So you could work through this in sort of all of the nitty-gritty details. It's going to be eight-dimensional, so you could use a set of vectors like this to represent each of those Gell-Mann matrices that we saw earlier. And you could write down 8x8 matrices that correspond to whose action on these vectors correspond to the commutation relations for the Lie algebra. Going through all those details isn't super illuminating. The point is that if you were to do all of that, the eigenvalues that you would get could be plot like this, where we've got six brightly colored ones and two in the middle that are both zero. It's a zero, zero weight, but you have two of them. It gives you eight total weights for the eight different basis elements. Okay. Now, as my labeling here suggests, it's these states here that can be thought of as combinations of color and anti-color. There are a couple of different ways to see how that can be. The most straightforward way is to just compare this with the weight space we had before. And notice in the weight space, if you think of weights as vectors now, each of these states here on the right, these adjoint representation-y states, can be thought of as a straightforward vector sum of some color state here, so say red, and anti-green over here. If you were just add those up, it would take you to precisely this space, to this point here in the space. And the two in the center are things like red anti-red plus green anti-green, these sorts of things. Okay. So what does that give us? The key is that these weights correspond to basis vectors for V anytime you're looking at the weight space of a representation. In the specific case of the adjoint representation, Again, that carrier space is the Lie algebra. And so for our purposes, what's important is that then any element of the Lie algebra can be written in that basis. Anytime I give you a Lie algebra valued thing, you now have a way of thinking of it as written in a basis like we have here on the right. These combinations of color and anticolor. So the big upshot is the algebra valued quantities can be thought of as these combinations of color and anticolor. And so when we circle back around to scalar chromodynamics, the conserved current that we have that's Lie algebra valued can be thought of as this sort of combination of color and anticolor. And it's that sort of quantity that Noether's theorem says is conserved, rather than red on its own and blue on its own and green on its own. Good. Okay. So now let's circle back around and think a little bit about what this real quantity is more generally, both in the case of electric charge and color charge. What sort of property is this thing? At this point, you might be wondering, that was a lot of fun math about color charge. Isn't color charge supposed to be like electric charge? Can I do the same things with electric charge? And turns out all of the like important mathematical steps for getting this interpretation of color charge carry over straightforwardly to the case of U1 symmetry and electric charge, but in mathematically boring ways, that you wouldn't ever notice. So in particular, in the top here for electromagnetism, where phi is your matter field, that's just a charge scalar field. You just think of it as a complex number. Well, it turns out you can think of those complex numbers as vectors in a carrier space for a representation of U1. And here's how you would do it. So U1 is the circle group. It looks something like this in the complex plane. So that one there is thought of as the identity element. Z and W are picked out as just sort of exemplary elements of the group. The group operation is just adding up those angles that represent those elements. So that ZW over there is the result of adding those two group elements. Okay, it's commutative. That's all it is. So this circle here captures the structure of the group, where that has to do with preserving the group operation. So this Z plus W goes to ZW operation. With a little bit of thinking, you can realize, well, there are lots of other ways to embed precisely that same structure onto the circle, right? So you could map Z and W to 2Z and 2W, just rescale the whole thing, stretch it out or squish it down. And that's precisely what you do with the different with the inequivalent irreducible representations of U1. They all look something like this, where you index each of the different representations with this little n, and what that means is that you've rescaled the way you think of these elements as being embedded onto that circle. But now for each of those different representations, they all have the same carrier space. You're still thinking of it in terms of just the complex plane. So when you have a charge scalar field for electromagnetism, you can still think of that, if you wanted to, as taking values in a carrier space for a representation of the group. Now, seen this way, it turns out that the adjoint representation is row 0. It's the trivial representation. So that's the one that takes all of these group elements and just maps them all back to the identity. Really boring. But if you wanted to, there'd like mathematically not be any real reason to do this, but if you wanted to, you could think of that adjoint representation as being built up out of a representation for positive electric charge, +1, and a representation for negative electric charge, -1, in mathematically the same way, I'm saying we should think of the adjoint representation for color charge as these combinations of color and anti-color. It's just that in this case, you kind of don't need to do that. You don't have the same complexity of three different colors and three different anti-colors to coordinate. So you don't have to do that. In addition, in this case, the Lie algebra is just the real line. So things like the current or the gauge field are Lie algebra valued. You just don't have any reason to point out that they're Lie algebra valued, because what you see there is a real number and you go, I know what that is, that's a real number, I know how to interpret that, there's nothing special about it. But if you wanted to, you could observe, that's the Lie algebra in this case. Okay. So what this suggests is, I think, that you might want to kind of take the analogy between color charge and electric charge and flip it on its head. It's not that color charge is like electric charge. It's the other way around. Electric charge is like color charge, but in some degenerate, simplified ways. So then briefly, just to sort of circle back around to looking forward to when we're able to graduate from this simplified case of scalar electrodynamics and scalar chromodynamics to really getting at particle physics. If you stay with this scalar case and didn't worry about spin, you get this sort of diagram in the case of color charge. And you can think of conservation of color charge, again in this case, as at the vertex, where here, what this diagram would say is, you could have a red quark coming in, and it interacts with a gluon that has the type of charge that is this combination of green and anti-red. And in that interaction, there's this exchange where the gluon gives the quark its green and takes away its red, which is compensated by its anti-red. And so at the vertex, you still have conservation of charge in the sense that, like, all of the reds, blues, greens, and their corresponding anti-colors are all accounted for. So this is just a sort of relational way of thinking about charge. Right, you have this combination of the color and the anti-color that the gauge field has, and it bears some relation to your matter fields. And it has to be in the right relation to get this sort of color conservation. Again, you could go back and think of electric charge this way if you wanted to. It would just be kind of boring. Because in that case, your gauge field doesn't carry any charge, and so it can't give any or take any away. But you still get the same sort of conceptual structure of charge conserved at the vertex. So in summary, here's what I think the takeaways are. What Noether's theorem gives you is not that the reds, the blues, and the greens are individually conserved. That's just not what the theorem gives you. Instead, it gives you this conservation of a Lie algebra valued thing. And the way that I think we should think of that Lie algebra valued thing is as a combination of both charge and anti-charge, quite generally, but especially in the case of electric charge. And then moreover, there's a sense in which this conservation of charge is really a relational thing about different types of quantities that have to fit together in the right way. Thank you very much. Yeah, if you quantize the gauge field, you'll get gluons.
You're starting off not just with a set of red, green, and blue. You're trying to deal with the forces.
Yeah.
So that's what the angle is.
That's where it comes in.
So how does that relate to the, how should I say, to the conservation? Conservation is given to you by the adjoint.
So the conservation comes from Noether's theorem, which says that the current is conserved, or divergence free. And the key is that in your expression for the current, you have to care about
the gauge field that's in your covariant to operate it. So that's where it comes in.
So now let's go back to the charge itself. You have a current, you get the photon out of that?
An electric charge? I don't know of a way in which the electric charge current gives you photons.
Well,
if
you have the current.
You have the current.
If you have the current,
mm-hmm.
you get a photon, but that would be actual.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where, again, you can think of the adjoint representation as, telling you something about the gauge field. And moreover, in the case of electric charge, where the adjoint representation is the trivial representation, that's the sense in which we say photons don't have charge. Anything that transforms according to a non-trivial representation has charge, is charged. But if you are in the trivial representation, then you don't have charge. And it's the special thing about U1 that its adjoint representation is the trivial representation. Yeah. So that does give you photons in that sense.
So I agree at the classical level that whether my quantization or similar. But after quantization, they're extremely different because all the charges are fine. So we never see charge.
Yeah.
So I really take the analogy between kind of push it too far.
So there are lots to say about that, I think, for sure. I'm definitely on board with the idea that there are going to be lots of important, interesting ways where the analogy between electric charge and color charge breaks down. But I'm not ready to say that we shouldn't care about it or there's not important morals to draw, right? So yes, definitely in the quantum case it's confined, but you still need this, the property of charge and the forces associated with it to account for that.
It's part of the theory. It's just that they qualitatively different. In electromagnetism, right, you can have a proton, you can have an electron, it can be far away, or be at each other, and you see it, but you never see anything that's charged.
Right, we never see that, no. But we have a pretty sophisticated theory about what's going on within hadrons,
yeah.
Even if we don't see it. That's definitely interesting and worth interviewing.
Yeah, I agree.
Great.
But this is where I think it gets really interesting in terms of ending up there in physics. I remember Raoul Bachmann-Hero, the other person who understood calculus in physics part, would say, I don't get physicists. They don't understand what a converse to a theorem is. Lenard's theorem says, less symmetries, you get conservation laws. These physicists do experiments that get conservation laws, but for some reason, they think they can put a couple of Lagrangian that has certain symmetries. They're Lagrangian designers. So in a way, Lenard's theorem gave the Lagrangian designers their language. So it's not like a theorem physicists use. It's a theorem that gave physicists their language. And in that case, yeah, it's kind of universal. The physics can look very different,
but
the language was given by her, and she was doing physics.
Yeah.
These guys just don't understand where the Congress is.
Yeah, I think that's...
There's nothing that guarantees that if you have a conservation law, you'll be able to couple of Lagrangian with symmetries.
Yeah, but if you have a Lagrangian and you have a conserved current, then the Lagrangian has a symmetry.
Yeah.
That's a converse.
Right.
Yeah.
But you gotta watch.
Yeah, there are definitely subtle details all over the place to be careful about, for sure. Yeah.
So I'll have a wild say. So, people talk about the Renaissance and science and Galileo, and it seems like the Renaissance was really about math, not science. And it seems like two of the coolest ideas coming out of mathematical physics that don't have anything to do with science, but they're the Lagrangian in the first place, and that can be traced back to Émile Duchâtelet. And Lenard's theorem, terms of giving language, it didn't come from observation of the world. And these two totally awesome ideas are willing to be hunted. And nobody kind of says the two most awesome ideas in mathematical physics, which are not physics or, you know, the language got. Nobody's ever riffed on that thing?
Not that I'm aware of.
Should.
Yeah.
All right, let's thank Mary again. All right, so I think we'll just take a 5-minute break, and we'll just start a little bit early. So if you want to help yourself, you have plenty of refreshments in the back.